planning a homecoming parade for me. When we got off the plane, the Paps were waiting there for us, just as I knew they would be. "Jennifer, Jennifer," they screamed as they photographed her. Not a single Leah. No one had stopped me for a shot of my fabulous get-off-the-plane outfit. And the only image of me getting off the plane is a corner of my forehead behind Jennifer. But to be fair, it was chaotic with all the fan security and camera flashes. Maybe they had just missed me. I mean, I had been standing behind Jennifer, who towers over me. No problem. There would be plenty more outfits where this came from. The next ensemble I chose for a little stroll up the Spanish Steps was my Shop in Rome outfit. A ruffled white turtleneck, black slacks, capped off by a Chanel coat, and 4-inch Gucci heels. After 3 hours of preparation, I was finally ready to grab Angelo and leave the secured hotel right near the steps where the wedding party was staying. "We're going to be swarmed by reporters and photographers," I predicted to Angelo. I steeled myself to face the crowd of hundreds who had lined up behind velvet ropes set up around the perimeter of the hotel in hopes of catching a glimpse in real life of the celebrities who were attending the wedding, including, of course, me and Angelo. After putting on my very expensive sunglasses and taking Angelo's arm, I walked out of the lobby and bravely waited for the firestorm of fans and Paps clamoring for me. Silence. I took off my sunglasses. More silence. "I guess your show doesn't air in Italy," Angelo said. Angelo, who wanted to go to the Colosseum, grabbed a cab for us. When we got out, there was a large group of tourists waiting to get into the ruin. My time to step in, I walked past the group and up to the man standing at the front of the gate. I asked him if he had ever watched the show King of Queens. He said he did not and told us to get back in line. Playing hardball, the Italians. Apparently, my street cred as a celebrity did not travel. My feet were killing me, so after Angelo took a picture of us, the only one from the whole trip, we went back to the hotel to get ready for the welcome dinner, the first event of the weekend. Almost all of the 150 guests invited to Tom and Katie's wedding, which included some of the biggest names in all areas of the business, actors and actresses, of course, but also heads of the major talent agencies, top entertainment lawyers, and well-known producers in Hollywood, piled into Nino, a classic cozy Roman restaurant about an hour from the hotel. Old Italian waiters in starched white jackets and black bow ties hustled around the bride and groom's famous friends like Will and Jada Smith, Victoria and David Beckham, Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy, who were dating at the time, and Brooke Shields and her husband, Chris Henchy. I had been totally shocked when I saw Brooke Shields on the chartered plane to Italy that we shared. After the whole brouhaha, when Tom attacked her on the Today Show for taking antidepressants, I thought she was our enemy and had even said some shit about her in defense of Tom in my church. "I wouldn't trust someone who had those feelings with a baby," I remarked on Entertainment Tonight. "Do I think she needs help? Yes. Can you take a pill for something that deep, that dark? The answer is no." I got through it, but I didn't get through it by taking a pill. Then I had the pleasure of being on a private plane with her for 8 hours. To my mind, it was clearly a PR move on the part of Tom's team. And then they were forced photo ops to the press to capture which celebrities and Hollywood big shots were attending the wedding. Thus, it looked like they were associating themselves with Scientology and Scientologists. Although the restaurant was located on a street where it was easy for cars to drive right up and drop people off at the entrance, the wedding planners chose instead to have the street roped off. So we all had to get out of our cars on the main avenue and walk down the street to the restaurant with camera flashes going off the entire way. The church, in a very calculating way, could point to this photo or that photo and say Posh and Bex or Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony are associating themselves with this wedding and therefore with Scientology. It was a smart way of legitimizing the church to the public and an attempt to recover from the bad PR of recent years. It also promoted the illusion of, look how powerful Scientology is in this business. At dinner that night, I saw everyone who was from the church for the first time. I spotted a young Sea Org member who worked for David Miscavige, COB, drinking red wine. I was more shocked at the sight of a Sea Org member drinking, something that I'd never seen before and something that was completely against policy. "What are you doing?" I said to the kid. "You know, Sea Org members are not supposed to drink." He responded, "You know what they say, when in Rome." Someone who was representing the church at such a high-profile moment was completely flouting its rules. Most Scientologists, even just parishioners, don't really drink because they are always on course, and the rule is no drinking 24 hours before you are on course or going into session. Sea Org members are held to an even higher standard, as they are the ones who deliver Scientology to its parishioners. To see one drinking would be as weird as seeing a priest doing a tequila shot. It's just not done. Jessica Feshbach and Tommy Davis, the Sea Org members who had become constant fixtures at Tom and Katie's house in L.A., were in Italy without their respective spouses and had their hands all over each other at the restaurant, another major taboo. Sea Org members are absolutely forbidden from touching members of the opposite sex aside from their spouses. So at dinner, when Mark and Jen, having no idea who Tommy and Jessica were, asked if they were married, my face went red with embarrassment. But then Jessica took it to a whole other level. "No, I'm married to a beaner," she said, using a racial slur for her Mexican husband. "Jessica," I interjected. "What? I can say it. I mean, I'm married to a Mexican. I'm telling you, it's offensive." She was married to a high-ranking Sea Org member. I wanted her to stop embarrassing herself and get her shit together. Back in L.A. a few weeks before the wedding, I had asked my assistant at the time to call ahead to the hotel to check on the rooms. I asked her to make sure I was in a big enough room so that Jennifer and I could get ready together. She had upgraded the smaller room I had been assigned and verified that the new room wasn't one from the block reserved for the wedding party and that it was charged to my credit card, not to the wedding party. The next thing I got was a nasty call from Jessica. "Who are you to be changing rooms?" I couldn't believe I had a Sea Org member calling me about rooms. It was like a rabbi calling you about why you switched the mimosa for a Bloody Mary at brunch. "You're ungrateful," she said. "Why should I be grateful? I'm going to a wedding." "Because you're going to the wedding of the century." So while I might have come off as ungrateful to them, Jessica and Tommy still pulled me in as the church's unofficial liaison to Jennifer and Mark. I had to answer tons of questions. What kind of car does she need? What does she like to have in her hotel room? What kind of security does she need? Why is this a concern to them, I wondered. I found it odd that top church officials, Sea Org members, were so involved in the planning of Tom and Katie's wedding. This was unprecedented and off policy to my mind. Not only were these high-ranking executives involved in orchestrating the event, they were also all in attendance at the event. To me, it could only be viewed as Tom and Katie's wedding now being regarded as official church business. I cannot shed the thought that Tom must be an unofficial executive of the church. When I brought this up to church officials later on, they went to great lengths to deny it. All parishioners, including Tom Cruise, are considered equals and treated accordingly, was their pat response. My confusion and anxiety about what was going on with my church only increased that night at Nino, where David Miscavige was one of the guests. The bizarre part about him that evening was that his female assistant, Larice Stuckenbrock, was sitting next to him like she was his date. It would have been okay if she stood off to the side, ready to assist him when needed, but this was just weird. She was in the seat that should have been reserved for his wife, Shelley. Where was she anyway? Strange not to have your wife, who is also COB assistant, at an event like this. Suri was also there that night. I heard a baby crying from the direction of the bathroom. She was a 7-month-old, up late in a loud, crowded, dark restaurant, so what else was she going to do? The crying kept up, and Katie didn't seem to notice. Other people took notice, though, and started to look around to figure out what was going on with the baby. I, too, kept looking around. Is anyone going to do anything, I thought. After about 5 minutes, I headed to the bathroom to offer some help. When I opened the door, I found three women, including Tom's sister and his assistant, standing over the baby, who was lying on the tile floor. I didn't know if they were changing her diaper or what, but the three women were looking at her like they thought she was L. Ron Hubbard incarnate. Rather than talking to her in a soothing voice, they kept saying, "Suri! Suri!" in a tone that sounded like they were telling an adult to get her shit together. "What are you guys doing?" I asked. But I didn't wait for an answer. "She's a baby. Pick her up." I'm hardly mother of the year, but even I knew that she was probably hungry and tired. But when I asked where her bottle was, they said it was outside in the main part of the restaurant. It had to be heated up, and they seemed hopeless. "Oh my God, you guys, we're in a restaurant where typically there's a kitchen," I said. "I'll handle it." I grabbed the bottle from Suri's diaper bag, went into the kitchen, asked someone to warm it up, which of course was no problem, and returned to the bathroom, where Suri was still on the floor and still crying. "Pick her up," I yelled. They picked her up, gave her the bottle, and finally she stopped crying. And then Tom's sister turned to me and said, "Thank you," as if I were being dismissed. I came out, and from his table, David Miscavige mouthed to me the words, "Is she okay?" to which I silently replied, "Yes." When I got back to my seat next to Jennifer, however, I found that Jessica had taken it. I didn't care so much about my seat, but I wanted my phone, which I had left on my seat. I wanted to call home and check on Sophia. I hovered near her and looked for the phone, but didn't see it by my play setting. "Did anyone see my phone?" I asked, but no one had. I started to get hysterical as people either shrugged no or ignored me altogether. I turned to Jessica, the very last person I felt like dealing with, and said, "Excuse me," as I started to feel around the chair for my phone. "What's next, chick?" she said with a laugh. "You want to fuck me?" "No, what's next, Jess, is I'm going to punch you in your fucking face." The weirdness of the night was starting to get to me. When tears started to form in the corners of my eyes, it was Brooke Shields, of all people, who asked me if everything was all right. She was sitting nearby and was witnessing what was going on. She helped me look for my phone, but we still couldn't find it. I walked outside the restaurant to take a moment, but Jessica followed me. She held my phone up in one hand. "You still want to punch me in the fucking face?" she asked. "Now, more than ever." Just then, Mark Anthony appeared. "Lee, don't be mad at her," he said. "It was me. I took your phone. I'm so sorry. I was just playing with you." I didn't believe it was him at all. I was pretty sure he was just trying to defuse the extremely tense situation. The next few days leading up to the wedding didn't get any easier. I felt like Jessica and Tommy were watching my every move, and every move I made was wrong. Even on the afternoon of the wedding, Jessica was on my ass. We still had a few hours before we needed to be at the castle for Tom and Katie's wedding, an hour outside of Rome. But Jessica kept texting me that I needed to get down to the lobby of the hotel right away. When I texted back that I was going with Jennifer and we would leave when Jen's security team gave us the okay, they were in communication with the security team at the venue, she kept insisting that I go now with the Scientology group, not with a guest of the wedding. As if my role at this wedding was to publicly show my affiliation to the church rather than to my close friend. Then Jessica told me if I didn't come now that I would be late. Jennifer, whom I was getting ready with per our original plan, finally asked, "Who keeps texting you?" "Oh, nobody." Now I was acting weird too. "Who's texting you?" "Oh, no one. It's just they're just wondering if we were ready." "Tell whoever that is, we'll go when my team gives us the okay and not before." And with that, I stopped responding to Jessica's texts. We left a bit later and did arrive late, but Tom's sister and assistant were arriving at the same time, so I wondered how late could we actually be. I was trying my best to keep my behind-the-scenes drama with the church to myself. It would have been bad PR to do otherwise. But I was on edge as we pulled into the beautiful courtyard of the medieval castle, where trumpeters announced our arrival. The guest had to hike up the hill to the entrance, and in doing so, I stepped on my gown and ripped it. I was immediately taken up to a room where one of the 10 in-house seamstresses from Armani booked for the wedding sewed it right up. I then joined the rest of the guests, who were being served champagne in a room with a fireplace that was big as my living room. It was here, standing among Tom's assistants, that I casually asked them, "Where's Shelley? She should be here." Again, I thought it was so odd that she was not there. Total bad PR. In the past, Shelley was always by David's side. They responded with, "I don't want to be part of this conversation," and walked away. Afterward, I saw Tommy Davis and asked him the same question. I hadn't seen Shelley for a few years now. I had heard she was on some type of special assignment, but I had my suspicions that the truth was far worse. I mean, wherever she is, you could have dusted her off, cleaned her up, and gotten her here, I said. Tommy replied, "I think it's odd that you're asking." "No, it's odd, being that you are the spokesperson for the church, that you didn't have enough sense to realize that not having her here is a bigger PR blunder than anything." "You don't have the rank to be asking about Shelley Miscavige," he replied, and with that, he shut down the conversation. We filed into the chapel where the ceremony was to take place. Everyone took their seats. Then Norman Starkey and Tom entered and took their places at the front of the chapel, and inexplicably, for the next 20 minutes, but what seemed like an eternity, Tom stood there with that "everything's great" look plastered on his face, even as the crowd grew uncomfortable. Finally, Jennifer leaned over and whispered in my ear, "Do you think Katie's coming?" Eventually, she did walk down the aisle. Tom and Katie wed in a Scientology ceremony where they vowed to never close their eyes and sleep on a disagreement or an upset. David Miscavige acted as Tom's best man, and Jessica was by Katie's side most of the time. Then we all headed to the receiving line to greet the newlyweds. Tom and Katie hugged and said hello warmly to everyone, except Angelo and me. They bypassed us completely and moved on to kiss Jennifer and Mark. "What did we do?" Angela said as we walked into the reception. I just shrugged because I really didn't know. Was it the fact that we were late and set them off? And if so, why weren't they mad at Jen and Mark too? Or the fact that I asked for a different room? I didn't think either of those things warranted their flat-out dismissal of us. Along with the rest of the guests who were talking and mingling, we filed into the castle's grand hall of the Caesars to find our tables and take our seats for dinner. The opera singer Andrea Bocelli filled a dark hall with Italian love songs in his booming voice. Jennifer, who had picked up our table assignment cards, realized we weren't at the same table and asked what was going on. When I said I didn't know, she replied, "Well, I don't want to sit with people I don't know." I wasn't sure what was going on either, except that church members had been trying to separate me and Jen ever since we had arrived in Italy. The only explanation I can come up with was that they viewed me as just a springboard for Tom and Katie to get to Jennifer and Mark, and for the church to get them for recruitment. The day before the ceremony, when we were leaving for the rehearsal dinner, Jessica and Tommy had wanted me to go in a van with other church people, even though I told them I was driving with Jen and Mark, who had their own car and security. In the hotel lobby, Tommy tried to pull me aside. "Leah," he said, motioning for me to go toward the van, but Jen, who didn't know what was going on, said, "She's with us." "Oh, yeah, no problem," he replied. The same thing happened at the dinner hosted by Katie's parents, who had very little presence at the wedding. As the four of us sat down at a table, Tommy called over to me, "Leah and Angelo, you're over here." But again, Jennifer said, "No, she's with us." And again, Tommy backpedaled. "Oh, yeah," he said. "I think there was just a mistake on the tables. Let me just change some things around." Although we returned to the hotel at 4 a.m. after a long night out with some other wedding guests, as soon as Angelo and I left Jen and Mark, Tom and Katie knocked on their door to see if they wanted to take a walk on the beach with them alone. I thought, it's almost like someone had been watching and knew the moment we left. But I'm sure I'm just being paranoid. When it turned out that Jennifer and I weren't at the same table at the wedding reception, she asked me to talk to the wedding coordinator to see if we could sit together. I felt responsible for Jennifer since I had invited her and Mark to the wedding on Tom and Katie's behalf. I'm sure she thought that I could communicate more easily with other Scientologists since I was one. For me to say to her otherwise would have been bad PR. What I failed to realize at the time, and what would later go down as a transgression, was the fact that me sitting with Jen meant that I was not placed at an assigned table where I could be used effectively by the church to promote Scientology among non-Scientology guests at the wedding. They viewed this as a hostile act. So, Knowing I was already in trouble, I approached the wedding planner with a very light touch. Is there any way we can add 2 chairs to our table, or is that too much? I don't want to make a big deal about this. She assured me it was not a problem, and I breathed a sigh of relief. The reception made my stomach turn as a Scientologist. I watched Jessica openly flirting with Tommy, which was nothing compared to the sight of Norman Starkey, the Scientology minister who had performed the wedding ceremony, getting handsy and inappropriately dancing with Brooke Shields. Starkey was a church leader who had captained one of the original Sea Org ships when LRH was still alive and who was close to Scientology's founder. I kept my mouth shut, though, through the whole night, which included the traditional cake cutting with, of course, Tom making out with Katie, fireworks set to classical music, a party after the reception at another castle hall that turned into a nightclub with superstar DJ Mark Ronson spinning. With all eyes on Tom, he put on quite a performance, reprising his famous Top Gun moment by singing You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. An odd choice of song for a groom to be serenading his new bride with, but okay. Directly to Katie, who played the part of the perfect bride. So I was relieved when at some point the hall seemed to empty out of A-listers. Angelo, Mark, Jennifer, and I climbed into her car and headed back toward the hotel. But halfway through the drive to the hotel, I got a call on my cell phone from one of Tom's lackeys, Michael Dovin. Hey, where are you guys? He asked. I explained that we were in the car on the way back to the hotel. Right, he said, and I'm telling you, you need to come back. Not knowing what else to say, this was beyond crazy, I said, here, talk to Jennifer, and I handed the phone over. Hey, I could hear him say on the cell to Jennifer, sounding loud and nervous. So, Tom and Katie really want you to come back. We're already 45 minutes into the drive and really tired. We didn't know where you guys were, she said. Well, we just went into the kitchen with a bunch of people to make pizza. Everybody was hungry. Oh, well, you know, I love the wedding. It was great. You sure you don't want to come back? Tom really, really wants you to come back. No, sweetie, we're going back to the hotel. Are you sure? What the fuck? Leave it alone! Had everyone in my church lost their minds? This is all just too weird. Top officials were here and going against everything I was taught and believed to be right. I had seen behind the curtain. There, in the role of the great and powerful Oz, was not LRH, as I had come to believe, but instead, it seemed to be Tom Cruise. All of these rules appeared to have been broken because of or in relation to him and his standing in the church. Was my church falling apart? Was Tom in charge? As soon as I got back to the room, I called my mom, and in between sobs, I told her everything that had been going on. I think Jessica's cheating on her husband with Tommy, I ranted. Norman Starkey is drinking and humping Brooke Shields on the dance floor. I think I saw David Miscavige's assistant touching him inappropriately at the welcome dinner. And Suri was on the floor and these women were talking to her like she was LRH. She was in total disbelief and agreed that I had to write it up in knowledge reports. I then called my assistant back home, who was also a Scientologist, and relayed the details of what I had witnessed to her. She was as devastated as I was. I need the facts. Give me the facts, she kept saying over and over. I'm writing it up for the Watchdog Committee, the highest management group in the church, charged with overseeing Scientology activity worldwide. Give me the details. This is our church, I said. How can the highest members of our church, the most so-called devout and esteemed members, just ignore policy and operate so outside the lines of what is expected of them and of us? How did Tom amass all of this power? And why is he treated like a church official? Doesn't anyone else care that this is happening? Let's get it handled, she replied. I agreed with her that we needed to handle things by solving the problem, which, in my view, was Tom Cruise and David Miscavige. I was still L. Ron Hubbard's girl, and I remained confident that if I operated within his world, by his policies, writing up everything I had witnessed these last few days, that I was going to be the one to solve the church's problems, that my friends would stand by me in this important work. I couldn't wait to leave Italy and get back home. But when Jennifer invited Angelo and me to return on the jet she decided to charter on her own, Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey, Will and Jada Smith, and the Beckhams all chartered their own jets home instead of taking the one provided by Tom and Katie, I declined. I would have liked nothing more than to go home with her, but if we did that, it would mean another whole day of not seeing Sophia, which I definitely didn't want to do. The chartered jet that Tom and Katie had provided was going back earlier, so I thanked her but explained that I had to get back. On the way to the airport from the wedding, Angelo and I found ourselves in the same van as Bella and Connor Cruz. Over the years at the Celebrity Center, I had watched Tom and Nicole Kidman's children grow up, but more recently, I'd gotten to know them better by spending time with them at Tom's house. The siblings, who were supervised by Sea Org members, often had their computers taken by the security force at Celebrity Center to make sure they weren't up to anything and to keep filters on so they couldn't go on any websites that might get them asking questions. Still, Connor was a bit of a rebel. He would show up to course a little disheveled from whatever fun he was able to steal. I had always wondered why they didn't have a relationship with their mom, but I could never ask them because there was always someone else around. Driving to the airport alone with them, I had my chance. "Hey guys, how's your mom? Do you see her a lot?" I asked. "Not if I have a choice," Bella said. "Our mom is a fucking SP. I was shocked by her answer. "I've never seen her do anything publicly to give her that label, and she is your mom." Bella scoffed and said, "Well, she is." Connor just looked out the window. There was something more human about his silence and the sadness I felt in it. My heart broke for him, his sister, and their mother as we rode the rest of the way to the airport without saying another word. When he and I arrived at the private part of the airport, where everyone from the chartered flight was already lined up to get on the shuttle to depart, people ignored us and acted as though we had the plague. After we got on the plane, I settled into my seat next to Angelo and didn't really say much to anyone else for the rest of the trip back to the States. I felt horrible, confused, angry, betrayed, and without friends. But I didn't want to let anyone, not even Angelo, see how upset this whole experience had made me. I was a Scientologist, and I knew how to lean on my training and get my TRs in so I didn't show any reaction. I didn't know who I was going to turn to for this, but I knew that I was on a mission at this point to save Scientology. Chapter 14. After I returned from Italy, I had planned on going down to Flag for a 6 to 8 week upper-level course. The timing worked out perfectly since I had hiatus from the King of Queens. However, right after I got home from the wedding, my auditor, Todd Woodruff, my handler Shane's brother, called to tell me I was wanted down at Flag earlier than planned. I questioned if this directive had anything to do with what had happened at the wedding. If it did, I was not going to go. Todd downplayed the request, telling me that it was just a little ethics cycle I had to do, and that after that I would get on to OT7, no problem. This didn't seem like anything too terrible, so I agreed and dutifully packed up myself, Angelo, and Sophia, and headed to Flag. But almost as soon as I arrived in Clearwater, I was routed to ethics, where I was confronted with all the knowledge reports that had been written about me from the wedding. There were so many, it's hard to know where to begin. I guess I'll start with the plane ride to Italy, where someone I didn't know accused me of being drunk and disorderly, on a plane trip where I didn't touch alcohol. I hate flying, since it's the ultimate loss of power. There was no way I was going to relinquish my last vestige of control by drinking. And if I was going to die, I wanted to be alert enough to strangle my husband while we plunged to our death. Another report detailed how I had tried to steal Brooke Shields' hotel room from her, which was, as earlier noted, a strange twist of the truth. According to these reports, I was the rudest person ever to walk the face of the earth. All of my crimes were on the spectrum of things that you would have immature fights about in your teenage years. Apparently, the delay of the wedding ceremony, which started 45 minutes behind schedule, was my fault because I showed up late to the castle, as if Tom was waiting for me to arrive to get married. I had heard that the delay was caused by a reporter who had snuck onto Jenna and Bodhi Elfman's van to the wedding location and was trying to get access. Jasmine, the MAA conducting the interrogation, showed me the knowledge report written by Katie Holmes, in which she referred to my behavior during the wedding weekend as very upsetting, and accused me of disrupting the party, which she claimed was a poor example to others. She went on to say she made the party all about her and concluded the report with reference to the fact that all of this so-called bad behavior disturbed me greatly. Jasmine told me that I was a bad example for Scientologists and then asked me, "What do you say about this report?" What do I say about this childish report that looks like it was written by a seventh grader with all the exclamation marks? After that, she showed me Jessica Feshbach's knowledge report, where she went on and on about how she had to defend my actions to numerous people at various wedding events, including, but not limited to, CAA President Kevin Huvane and film producer Kathleen Kennedy. She wrote that I was perceived as loud, late, and rude, and that while I may have been trying to solve a certain problem, the way that I had apparently handled it was BPR, bad PR, for TC and Scientology. She claimed to have successfully managed and handled all of these complaints because she knew the real me. Both of these knowledge reports, like all that are written and submitted to the church, are assigned, "This is true," or "This is okay," meaning the person who wrote the report acknowledges that it is accurate in its reporting. Jasmine continued, "I just need to know what's true about it and what isn't true." We went through each report that way, because I wasn't about to back down. At this point, I felt LRH was on my side. It wasn't that I thought something was wrong with my faith. It was that there was something wrong with the people at the top, like Jessica and Tommy. Look, I copped to some shit. Yes, I'm rude, and I shouldn't have been late to the wedding and shouldn't have asked to change seats. But there was something way more alarming going on in our church. It was naive to think that I was saving my church when I filed knowledge reports on top officials in Italy like Norman Starkey for humping Brooke Shields, Jessica and Tommy for being inappropriate with each other, and none other than COB himself, David Miscavige, for letting his assistant treat him more like her date. While technically it's acceptable to write reports on people above you in the church, no one writes reports on senior executives and certainly not on COB. Although I didn't know it at the time, those who write up top officials are usually intimidated into recanting or wind up being declared suppressive persons. As a result of these knowledge reports, rather than partake in an ethics cycle as Todd had mentioned, I was instead sent into a sec check. With those reports I had written in Italy in her hand, my auditor went at me for hours, days, weeks, and then months. It was relentless, absolutely relentless, as we went around and around on the same questions. What have you done to Tom? Do you have evil intentions toward Tom? Do you have sexual intentions towards Tom? What have you done to Katie? Do you have evil intentions toward Katie? What have you done to David Miscavige? Do you have evil intentions toward David Miscavige? It was understood that the only reason I was saying those things about such high-level Scientologists was because I myself was guilty of those same crimes. You're a cheater, you're a liar, a homewrecker, I was told over and over. Well, yes, this was true, all true, I was a liar, a cheater, but that didn't change the facts that so were they, and they were violating Sea Org policy and LRH policy. The only way I could be done with it and leave Clearwater was if I retracted everything I said. They wanted me to say I didn't see David's assistant tap his ass affectionately or the young Sea Org member he brought along getting drunk. When I wasn't in session or ethics, I was in my room, crying and writing reports. Angelo, who felt so bad about seeing me so upset, thought the thing was nuts. He knew I was being put through the ringer, but I wasn't allowed to share with him the details of my sessions or what sec check questions they were asking me. Baby said, "Just say the word and we are out of here." He wasn't attached to Scientology in the way that I was. For him, it was simply a tool to better your life. And if it wasn't doing that, it was time to leave the church. He never got to Clear, despite spending more than $100,000 trying to get there. But for me, leaving was way too much to contemplate. As my mom explained, if I kept causing trouble, it was going to result in more problems for her, George, Shannon, and Shannon's boyfriend William, who were all auditing. Just get through it, Mom said. Answer their questions. I was completely responsible for the fate of so many people. There were no good choices before me. As I explained it to Angelo, either I decide that I'm going to drastically change everyone's life and we leave, or I have to say what they want me to say. Still, I continued to fight, thinking that at any point David Miscavige was going to barge into my auditing room and give me life protection from ethics for the way I had stood up for policy. Instead, my auditor, Reed, and my MAA, Jasmine, did a truth rundown, an interrogation process typically reserved for Sea Org members. In a truth rundown, the auditor looks at all the reports you have written, all the reports written by others about you, and all of the notes from your auditing sessions, ethics officer interviews, and any other material collected by the church to find critical reports or remarks about LRH, David Miscavige, or any person or policy of importance. Everything is fair game. So, for example, if I said Tom Cruise is an asshole, and I think he's damaging Scientology, the auditor would say, let's go to the earliest time you saw Tom being an asshole. In 2004, I saw him at a party, and he ignored the guy who handed him a water. Okay. So that was the earliest time you saw Tom being an asshole. Yes. Right before you saw Tom being an asshole, what overt or transgression did you commit? In response to the question, you have to find something that you did wrong. When that is answered, the auditor moves on to the next question. Was there an evil purpose or destructive intention that prompted you to commit that overt or transgression? You keep doing this until you get to the earliest time you can recall. And that's just for one report or one remark. Then the auditor goes on to the next report. When the reports are done, they go to the main part of the sec check, which is 200 different questions like, have you ever said anything derogatory about Scientology? The truth rundown worked. I started to crack. I begged E. Reed to stop, and when that didn't work, I looked into the camera in the wall of the auditing room and directly at the person watching the sessions. This is not LRH, I pleaded. You are destroying my and your own faith. Irit announced we were taking a break, and when she opened the door of the room, which automatically stops the camera from recording, she broke every policy in the church by whispering to me, answer the fucking questions, and let's finish this shit. In that moment, Irit didn't care about the truth or the technology. She just wanted me to get through it. Soon, I started to question what I saw. Maybe it is me. I have so many overts. I upset people. I did something to pull all this in. Exhausted after a long day of auditing, I lay down with Sophia, who was sleeping in one of the large hotel room beds. I stroked her beautiful brown hair and studied her innocent face. The last thing I thought before I fell asleep next to her was, what did you do to deserve such an evil person as a mother? After weeks and weeks of 12 hours a day in auditing, they broke me, and I retracted almost everything. I admitted that I caused a problem at the wedding. I admitted that I shouldn't have asked to change seats, and I held seats that caused upsets to people at the wedding. I guess that was true. And then I started in on the process of creating good effects to offset my transgressions at the wedding that caused bad effects. So in the this equals that cosmology of Scientology, because I had bad manners, I had to purchase Emily Post books for the library at Flat. I was making up the damage everywhere. I sent gift baskets accompanied by letters of apology to wedding guests like J.J. Abrams, who I was told I also upset. I bought everyone staying at the Fort Harrison a Christmas gift. And lastly, I spent $2,000 on framing the invitation and other mementos from the crew's wedding in a picture box for Katie, which I sent along with a note that said, I'm so sorry that I destroyed your wedding. Katie responded with a text, just handle it with your MAA. So, after I recanted, admitted to what they wanted me to admit to, said I didn't see what I saw, and created good effects, the church took away my ability to move up to the next OT level, even though I had already been made to do the first course of OT7, which is OT6 at night until midnight for 4 weeks. When I returned home, I would no longer continue to move up the auditing side of the bridge to the highest OT levels, but would be required to train as an auditor on the other side of the bridge, the training side. It wasn't just a change of direction, but also a major slap on the wrist, a demotion of sorts. Training as much as 8 to 12 hours per day of drilling the data and delivering Scientology to others was a clear punishment. They basically said, "She's trouble, so let's punish her." I fully believe that this directive came from specific individuals and not LRH policy. After staying at Flag for 4 months, spending $300,000 on auditing to get reprogrammed and making up damage, I was finally told I could go home. My return coincided with the end of our hiatus from the King of Queens, and not long after I got home, I was back on set where everyone was talking about their amazing vacations in Hawaii and how relaxed they were. "Leah, how was your hiatus?" Kevin asked me. "Oh, yeah, it was great," I said. "I was in Florida getting my ass handed to me for changing a fucking seat. What'd you do?" "I was in Florida for a while." When it came to talking about my role and required activities in the church, I would often lie to people. When a non-Scientologist girlfriend asked me how things were going with Angelo, I never admitted to the usual marital problems that couples have because that would have been revealing something less than the perfect image demanded of Scientologists. The list of workarounds to keep up appearances goes on and on. Being a Scientologist was like having a double life. When Jennifer asked me, "Oh, so you're going to Florida after you return from the wedding," like it was a casual trip to Disney with Sophia, I wanted to scream, "I'm going to Florida after Katie and Tom and everyone else wrote 5,000 reports on me because I asked to change a seat at the wedding." But I couldn't say anything other than an equally casual, "I got to do some auditing." Unless I wanted to be in deeper trouble with my church. I couldn't even tell Angelo about the full extent of what was going on at Flag every day while he hung out with Sophia by the pool, since it would discourage him from being on course. So I kept it all to myself, which was the loneliest feeling in the world. Just because I had made up the damage for my time in Italy in Scientology didn't mean that everything was fine in the real world. I heard through a few different people that Tom's agent, Kevin Huvane, was going around telling people how disgusting I was at the wedding and how much he hated me. Anybody allied with Tom felt they had to jump on the bandwagon. I didn't blame Kevin for his attitude. If my friend told me that someone had ruined his wedding, I would think she was a bitch too. But I didn't want Kevin, who also represented the likes of Jennifer Aniston, Julia Roberts, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Meryl Streep, hating me. So I picked up the phone and called his office to apologize. Naturally, he didn't take my call or call me back, so I kept calling until finally I got him on the phone. "Hey, I heard you wanted to represent me," I joked. "Not in a million years," he said. I was kidding. "Anyway, I'm sorry if you thought that I caused a scene at the wedding." Did you just say the word "if"? Somebody must have told you something incorrect because nobody told me anything. "Well, I just wanted to say I didn't make a scene. So, are you calling to apologize, or are you calling to lie to me?" Now, this is Tom's agent, the last person I need to be out PR with. I couldn't afford to have another report written on me. "So," I said, "I am sorry that I upset you. You are probably one of the most classless people I have ever met." "And you're an agent, so that's saying something." Nothing. Zero. Silence. "Okay, Kevin," I said, "I hope you can forgive me." As it turned out, I wasn't quite out of the woods with the church either. I certainly was persona non grata with Tom Cruise and his inner sanctum. However, there were also issues with my spiritual development. After all the time and money I spent in Florida, I was not getting onto OT7. Back home in LA, I accepted my fate and started auditor training. Still, I wondered if I was ever really going to be accepted by my church again, despite the countless commendations and rewards I have received from different members of the church in Sea Org. Or perhaps it wasn't so much that I wondered if I was going to be accepted, rather I thought, who the fuck are Tom and Katie? What kind of religion is this that my spiritual path is being dictated by actors? I wasn't there to be doing shit about Tom and Katie. I was there to get onto the next OT level. So when in 2007, Tommy Davis and Mike Rinder, at the time the executive director of the Office of Special Affairs, OSA, which oversees a wide range of the church's activities all over the world, from corporate issues to legal affairs to PR to investigations, including secret ones, asked me to join Ann Archer, Kirstie Alley, and Juliette Lewis in defending Scientology for a documentary the BBC was making on the subject, I agreed to do it. Inside the Hollywood Guarantee Building, the center for the church's secretive Office of Special Affairs, a place that most Scientologists never get to enter, we were briefed about the BBC reporter John Sweeney, who was working on the documentary. According to the files we read, he was essentially a liar with mental problems, a classic suppressive person. Tommy, leading the charge in discrediting Sweeney, said, "This guy's crazy. He's going to ask you all kinds of things. You know what to do. Dead agent, all his questions." Scientologists are often prepared to respond with what's called dead agenting, a method of shutting down any criticism of the church by disproving the veracity of the source of the information. A common dead agenting strategy is to sidestep any questions from outsiders that could hurt the church and focus instead on exposing supposed lies the source told or attempt to undermine his or her credibility with ad hominem attacks. We learn to first ask questions like, "Do you still beat your wife?" Then only offer partial truths in response to their questions, and finally try and deflect by referring to positive things the church has done. When I was younger, I had the dead agent questions during interviews all the time about why I quit school in eighth grade. As stated earlier, formal education is not important in the church, which prefers that all people, even children, focus their studies and life on Scientology. But of course, to the outside world, that would reflect poorly on my faith, so I told all sorts of half-truths, if not outright lies. From my mother homeschooling me, she did open a school later, to my going to a private school, the Sea Org, not really a school, but still an education. Even though Scientology sees itself as the authority on ethics and responsibility, obscuring the truth is built into its core. You can't give up the details of what's involved on the OT levels because, you are told, those who are not on them aren't ready to receive that kind of information. They might die if I told them, no kidding. That meant if I were directly questioned about the upper levels of Scientology, I had to lie. It wasn't really a lie if it was for the betterment of the church. The day after our briefing, Juliette, Kirstie, Ann, and I went to the Celebrity Center for our interviews with John Sweeney. A bald British man with glasses, he was already on edge when he arrived, but Tommy and Mike ridiculed and intimidated him in a way that embarrassed me. It was one thing to avoid a question and another to berate someone into not asking it. When I sat down with Mr. Sweeney, I prepared myself for the usual assaults against Scientology. Question: doesn't it cost people hundreds of thousands of dollars to practice Scientology? Answer: there are plenty of courses that cost as little as $35, partial truth. Question: do you really believe that an alien Xenu came to the Earth millions of years ago? Answer: how about what Scientologists are doing for the planet today, like the New York detoxification program that has rid thousands of 9/11 rescuers and workers of harmful toxins they got at Ground Zero, a fact backed up by science? Deflect. Instead, he asked me point blank, "Does David Miscavige hit people?" What? I wasn't expecting that. Maybe Tommy was right about this guy. That was certainly a crazy question. There are allegations that David Miscavige beats people. I had never heard them. I could have answered just that. But instead, I decided to employ my favorite defense, making a joke. "Well, I've never been hit by him. Should I be insulted?" Okay, maybe it wasn't the best joke. Still, I think it was better dead agenting than what Kirstie said, answering the same accusation about David Miscavige by saying to Mr. Sweeney, "I wouldn't ask you if you're still molesting children." Classic church tool. It was Tommy and Mike, however, who heaped the most abuse on the BBC reporter, bringing up dirt they had on mistakes he'd made throughout his career and ridiculing him for being stupid and nothing but a failed reporter. At one point during the interviews, he had to excuse himself and go to the bathroom because he was so upset. I couldn't take it. There's nothing I hate more than seeing someone be humiliated, whether a Scientologist or not. I followed him to the bathroom, where I asked through the door if he was okay. He responded, "I just need a minute." I was more than aware of the fair game policy, which stipulates that anyone against Scientology may be deprived of property or injured by any means by any Scientologist without any discipline of the Scientologist, may be tricked, sued, or lied to, or destroyed. This policy essentially allows Scientologists to punish and harass enemies using any and all means necessary. The church has stated that this policy was canceled, but there is an exception. Quote, "If the person is an SP, this applies," end quote. In this way, Tommy and Mike were just following policy, as I always stated I was, but this made my stomach turn. I went back to talk to Tommy and Mike, who were still laughing about this poor man being in the bathroom. "What are you guys doing to him?" I said. "What you're doing is wrong. He's in your house. You should treat him with respect. I don't think we're doing ourselves any favors." Of course, they didn't listen to me. In fact, during the journalist stay in Los Angeles, Tommy bullied him far worse than I could have imagined. He had people follow the reporter, even showing up at his hotel room, though he didn't think anyone knew where he was staying. Eventually, Tommy egged him on enough that he broke the guy, who had succumbed to a screaming fit that was cleverly caught on video by the church, which posted the footage on YouTube days before the documentary aired. Mr. Sweeney, who is reprimanded by his bosses for the unprofessional outburst, issued his own apology, in which he said he let the BBC down, and I am ashamed. I wish he hadn't done that. The BBC had no idea what this man had had to endure. I didn't know about any of that until later, but I didn't need to know it to see what effect doing this documentary had on the journalist. I felt so bad about how he was treated at the Celebrity Center that I refused to be part of the project and never signed my release. Chapter 15. John Sweeney's documentary on Scientology, which aired on May 14, 2007, oddly enough, coincided with another major event happening in my life that was hard for me to handle. The very last episode of The King of Queens. Leaving that show was so difficult. It really was like ending a marriage, and that a lot of history happened in the 9 years we worked on it. When I looked at everything around me, the many people I knew, the many things I had achieved, they reminded me of the King of Queens. That was my home, a place where I felt I had finally been accepted somewhat in a business I never really felt part of. My house is the King of Queens, my wedding and baby, King of Queens, Kevin's marriage and first two babies, the King of Queens. It was also hard to say goodbye to a show that didn't get canceled, but just ended. Yes, there were reasons, first and foremost of which was Kevin's movie career, which took off after he did Hitch. Kevin didn't want to tarnish the series with its being canceled or going out with low ratings. The show was special to him, and he wanted to honor that. The show that critics called derivative and not funny enough became the 12th longest-running sitcom in all of television history. No matter how many awards we didn't win or how many times a network moved us around, our viewers were as loyal to us as Carrie and Doug were to each other. They were the ones who kept us on air, making us one of only a handful of sitcoms of that time period to make it to 207 episodes. So, in what was more of a collective feeling than a decision, we said, okay, this is it. It's time to end the show. And although our finale didn't come with the typical fanfare or press coverage, the end of The King of Queens was no less dramatic. When Kevin and I looked up at that old piece of wood above the doorway to the set that I promised on our first show we wouldn't see forever, but that we had looked at far longer than either of us ever imagined, we both started crying. We didn't even need to speak. Each of us knew exactly what the other was thinking. That's history, our history. I have never recovered. I miss him, our writers, the cast, and the crew every day. Where do you go from there? I didn't really know what I wanted to do after The King of Queens because it was such a big part of me. You don't do a show for that long only to walk right into the next one. My main goal for a few years after the finale was not to go into something else that would be a disgrace to what I had done for 9 years. In 2010, not long after I ran into CBS head Les Moonves and his wife and television personality Julie Chen at a party, my agent received a call about a new chat show for the network called The Talk. Created by Roseanne alum Sarah Gilbert as a time slot replacement for the long-running soap As the World Turns. The daytime talk show was pitched to me as six female hosts who would sit around and have candid discussions about our lives as moms, wives, sisters, and working women. We would tell real stories about real relationships and real problems. That excited me. It was also something totally different for me, which was appealing, even though I knew at some point I wanted to return to sitcoms. But CBS, the only network still doing traditional multi-camera sitcoms, offered me a development deal in tandem. I was thrilled to stay in the family and said yes to The Talk. The show, which premiered on October 18, 2010, with Julie, Sarah, Sharon Osbourne, Holly Robinson-Pete, Marissa Jarrett-Winoker, and me, turned out to be much more difficult than I had imagined. For the first time on TV, I wasn't playing a scripted character. I was just me, and I was scared. Initially, all of us co-hosts bonded, both on set and off. We went on outings to the zoo with our kids, hung out at one another's houses, and got along well. We shared a lot of moments together. Things started to break down among us when I realized that the producers wanted to script the conversation between the hosts, losing any sense of realness to the discussions. I had thought we were going to discuss spontaneous and authentic stories. Instead, this felt manufactured. As a result, I became an unofficial producer. The co-hosts and producers would come to me with ideas and I would weigh them and find what I thought was relatable. An example of this came up once in a Monday morning cast and producer meeting. The producers asked us what we did that weekend. Julie mentioned that she and her husband had gone to an event at which the president was speaking. The producers thought this would be of interest. What I found relatable and funny was that Holly was at the same event, only her seats were in the nosebleed section, while Julie and her husband Les were somewhere in the first 10 rows. Holly kept waving unsuccessfully to get Julie's attention. The difference in where they were seated was of interest and set up for a better conversation. But while I had what I thought were good ideas and a firm grasp on what our audience could relate to, my opinions and my mouth often got me into trouble. Celebrities often have a list of what they won't talk about. Understandable, I never wanted to talk about Scientology, ever. But sometimes when it came to guests on the show, it got to be ridiculous. For example, when Craig Ferguson was a guest on our Valentine's Day show, I thought it would be fun to talk to the late-night host about the worst gift he ever gave his wife on Valentine's Day. The note we got back from his publicist, however, read, "Don't talk about Craig's wife. He doesn't want to talk about his personal life. Why, is he getting divorced?" "No," they said, "he just doesn't want to talk about her." This was Craig Ferguson, not Brad Pitt, who I'm sure would have been happy to talk about his wife. As a result, I ignored Craig on air because I wasn't allowed to ask him any questions that people could relate to and I could relate to. I got tweets about it that day. "Why are you not talking to Craig? Why do you hate Craig?" I thought the six of us should have real conversations on the kinds of topics that women really talk about, like how sex seriously drops off after marriage. Like, for me, I want to have sex more, but by the time 8 o'clock hits, I'm too tired and I think I should have done it earlier. But I don't like daylight, so unless blackout curtains are on hand, I'm out, because I'm trying not to show my husband my cellulite. That would have been a fun conversation to have on daytime television. That would have been different, and a conversation Barbara Walters could never have on The View. I would want to hear that conversation. Crass, sure. But that's the kind of thing I'm interested in hearing. Now, I understand that when you're Julie Chen, you can't really talk about how your husband does annoying things like scratches balls, but still. Sharon Osbourne, the resident wacky matriarch of the show, is particularly fond of telling stories about herself on air that stretch the truth, but I really love Sharon's balls. That she can make up a good story and not worry about it. Sharon, being the grand dam of the talk, was necessary to the show's survival, but her crazy ways and eccentricities that played well on TV were harder to take as a co-worker. One day, I might find myself in a fight with her on set in between the camera rolling, and the next a crazily lavish present of a full-grown tree that must have cost her thousands of dollars shows up at my house with a note that would read, I'm such a twat. You just never really knew where you stood with Sharon, but when she told me, I am a true friend to you, I believed her. Having said that, while one day she was your best friend, the next she wasn't. When I would try to ask someone about it, they would reply with, oh, that's just Sharon. As her friend, I knew Sharon had problems with Julie. Wanting respect, not criticism, Sharon started to rail against everything from the 8 a.m. planning meetings to the upfronts in New York, which she didn't want to attend because CBS was giving her only one first-class ticket and a coach ticket. If she was going to attend the presentations, which all the networks made to advertisers, Sharon had to bring along her whole crew, hair, makeup, etc. She also didn't want to stay in the hotel that they were putting her up at. Sharon was so angry, she told Holly and me that she was going to quit the show. As difficult as Sharon may have been, I did quite enjoy her, and personally, I didn't want anyone leaving the show the first year. She had paid her dues in her career, and I felt she deserved much of what she was asking for. I called a meeting to see if we could work something out among ourselves, pay for the upgrade and share stylists or something. But instead of working things out, Julie and Sharon got into it. I could feel the tension quickly rising between them. Sharon accused CBS of being a cheap network. For America's Got Talent, NBC gave her a $50,000 budget for clothes. Julie fought back by boasting about CBS's superior ratings. It was delightful. Our very own Battle of the Network Stars. And in this corner, I spoke to Julie and persuaded her to give Sharon due respect, let her skip meetings, let her take days off, make her feel important. Sharon, Holly, and I also decided we were going to go to the network and make some changes on the set so no one individual was running us. But rather, we worked as a team. We thought this was the right move. The second season was going to be better. After all, it was a tough show, and we all had our moments. Out of all the women on the show, I had the most in common with Holly. As we were in similar situations, we didn't have husbands to pay the bills like Ozzy Osbourne or Les Moonves. Holly and I were the breadwinners of our families, so we had a different perspective that was probably more in line with Sarah's. But unlike Sarah,